Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering a new exciting development in the world of air traffic control.
Announced today, NAV Canada has broken ground on the country's first ever digital air traffic facility right here in Kingston. This temporary site will serve as the foundation for next-generation air navigation technologies before a permanent digital hub is established in the city. David Shepherd, NAV Canada's Vice President and Chief Technology Officer, explained in an interview with CFRC how Kingston's new facility will transform the current air traffic control model.
Yeah, it's very different in terms of the nature around how the services are going to be provided forward. Today, we have staff that work actually physically at a location in a physical building, looking at windows. Tomorrow, with this technology, the introduction of this technology, we'll be bringing in state-of-the-art cameras, equipment that will and high-speed networks that will bring in a video feed and simulate the out-the-window view onto a screen that can be independent of the location of where the service is provided from. And the technology that's available actually also includes significant improvements from what's available from out the human eye. So things like digital overlays, or you can see surveillance, automatic detection tracking, that all improves the safety environment for our employees and for the aviation community.
So why Kingston? Shepherd says a combination of factors made the city an ideal fit.
We ended up looking across the country to determine where we thought would make most sense to start trialing this technology and our first digital hub as well. And we ended up narrowing in within a region of a number of different cities. And Kingston was looked at for a number of different factors on three categories, work, live, and play. And it really was looking at it from an employee's perspective around the quality of life, not just at the work environment, but for their family and for themselves in terms of the city that they're living in. And so Kingston came out amongst the top within the region that we were looking for. In addition, it's got proximity to Ottawa, which is an important element, particularly for this first site, for our technical teams to go there and our operational teams to go there to trial the technology, but also the regulator, which is Transport Canada, to be part of the process as well and be able to hop in a car and go down to Kingston and see the technology as it's evolving to ensure that they're confident in the solution and the capabilities as well.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of got into it a bit there, but what does this mean for the city and our residents? What kind of opportunities will this bring?
So there's a number of opportunities that are going to pop up. One is just trialing the technology. So there is investment that's going in to Kingston even right now with this announcement. You'll see we're starting a fairly significant construction project to build out and expand the existing tower that's at the Kingston Airport to accommodate this digital facility. It also will mean a number of different jobs that will move into Kingston as well in terms of providing our traffic services. We've also just relocated a couple of technologists as well that will be there. So these are great jobs, and it's a great city, and so it will be a significant amount of opportunity for the city of Kingston.
The Kingston site is part of NAV Canada's broader Digital Aerodrome Air Traffic Services Initiative, joining a global shift already underway in 16 other countries.
Yeah, so we end up looking across the globe, really, to see who is doing what in air traffic control services using these digital facilities. And there's a number of really interesting models that are out there. One is in London City, where they end up remoting in a very busy airport into Swanwick, so it's the southern part of the UK. And the other one was in Norway, where there was a digital hub concept that we end up seeing, which was where we think the future is, where it's not just about moving single airports. It's looking at this much more holistically as an organization around how we can move multiple airports into a single location so that we can provide more staffing flexibility, we can concentrate sort of the technology investments in the future as well. And so looking at those models, we ended up mirroring ours off of the Norway model.
The permanent hub in Kingston is expected to be up and running in the early 2030s and will eventually host remote services for up to 20 airports.
Yeah, it's all dependent on how the technology evolves and getting through a number of stages of approvals for ourselves to make sure we're confident that the safety case behind it, the technology is functioning, and our operational staff are able to use it appropriately, and making sure our regulator with Transport Canada is also confident in the capabilities that we've demonstrated along the way. So there's a number of gates that we're moving along, but the more permanent solution is we're looking in the early 2030s for us working towards that. But there is, we're starting with Kingston at the Kingston Airport, and then we will be moving, we'll be adding one additional airport to trial out the remote capabilities within the next few years. Associated with that. And then after that, that's where we start building up the digital hub and scaling that up.
For now, Kingston will lead the way in testing Canada's aviation future. For CFRC News, I'm Christina Laurie, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the heroic actions of some Gananoque firefighters.
Thank you, Jesse. When Angie Atkins walked into the Gananoque Fire Station last week, she arrived not as a patient, but as a survivor offering thanks. Atkins, whose life was saved after suffering a cardiac arrest, presented life-saving awards to Deputy Fire Chief Andrew Kent, Captain Kevin Conway, CSO Dylan Champagne, and Firefighter Alan Smith. The team, operating under the direction of Fire Chief Andrew Dixon, worked together in an effort that ultimately saved Atkins' life. The cardiac arrest life-saving pin is awarded to first responders who treat a patient in cardiac arrest who goes on to recover well enough to be discharged from hospital. The Gananoque Fire Service released a statement noting that while the Atkins family expressed their gratitude, it was the firefighters who felt truly honored by her gesture. The statement added that the GFS felt honored to celebrate Atkins' strength and recovery alongside her loved ones. The service also recognized its dispatchers, who were not pictured at the presentation, but who worked behind the scenes to ensure the response ran smoothly. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News Owen Fullerton about the Power of Hope golf tournament.
Thank you, Dinah. A now 5-year running golf tournament in Kingston raised an all-time high $176,530 in support of prostate cancer care at Kingston Health Sciences Center, or KHSC. The 5th annual Power of Hope golf tournament was held on August 25th, featuring 148 total golfers, slightly more than the targeted number according to organizer Mike LaFrambois. LaFrambois himself was inspired to begin holding the golf tournament to raise money for prostate cancer research and technology after undergoing surgery himself for prostate cancer with KHSC in 2019. LaFrambois said his surgery was completed by a Da Vinci robot, a piece of equipment that was acquired thanks to a charitable donation. This led him to want to give back, but through finding a way that would be bigger than just his own individual donation. And so, the tournament follows the lead of the Rose of Hope golf tournament, which has raised over $3.5 million for breast cancer initiatives. Now, after 5 years, the Power of Hope golf tournament has raised over $740,000 cumulatively. LaFrambois says an added benefit has been the general awareness drawn towards prostate cancer. He says, well, he wouldn't call himself an expert. Passing down his own experience can be eye-opening to some people living with prostate cancer, as well as for future prevention. LaFrambois says the money they've raised through the tournament will go towards financing a second Da Vinci robot for KHSC, which he says will open a lot of doors for the Kingston community. Ultimately, LaFrambois said, being in any way part of working towards that goal has been deeply gratifying.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to the LJAI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the Greater Napanee Town Council's decision to defer to an ad hoc committee about the sale of a piece of land containing a CN rail track.
After much discussion at their meeting this week, Greater Napanee Council decided to defer a decision about selling a piece of land with a former CN rail line on it. Staff will wait to hear from the town's ad hoc committee on trails. In May of 2023, council held a meeting regarding the land in question and created the ad hoc committee on trails. The trail, previously used by the community for recreation, was recently closed following an increase in use of private property by individuals and motorized vehicles. The public portion of the trail ends soon after crossing Highway 401 and leaves no other option but for users to access non-public land if they wish to continue. The town has since blocked access over the bridge on advice of the ad hoc committee. Working on crossing the 401 is underway, but plans cannot be finalized until the MTO finishes widening the highway. The town is also waiting for clarity from the MTO on exactly how in-town trails will be able to cross Highway 401. Mayor Terry Richardson explained why they decided to defer to the ad hoc committee.
We've employed an ad hoc committee to do this work. They've done a marvelous bunch of work. We have a direction to go in. We should bring them back and have a conversation with them because they're the ones that did all the work on this. And so maybe what we should do is before we change direction, because we did have a direction with a resolution, before we change direction, maybe we should have a chat with them and see what their thoughts are. And then, because let's face it, none of us had worked on this, and we had six very able, competent people that worked on this thing. And I'll tell you, they came up with some solutions that I didn't think were possible. And I just don't think it's fair to the ad hoc committee for us to make a decision this evening without actually consulting with them. I just think we owe it to these six people to come and have a chat with us, because I got to admit, they have done an absolutely marvelous bunch of work on this thing.
The town CAO, Matthew Grant, originally recommended removing the resolution from the town's resolution tracker, but staff did not agree. Grant explains.
Since this report's been published, a number of council members have been kind enough to come forward and let me know that the initial report as written really missed the mark. And they explain their reasons why, and I have to agree with them. And what specifically members of council said to me was, by removing this from the resolution tracker, it doesn't sufficiently remind us of our obligation to the stakeholders that we made. And so for clarity, it was a good deed that was not necessarily well thought out. And council, who did not have any desire to change what we were doing, was kind enough to point that out. So it is my intention with some of the background information and an alternative to consider, to sort of put us back on track there.
Councillor Michael Shank explained why listening to the ad hoc committee's recommendation made the most sense.
We all agreed the ad hoc committee said, we're going to close the railway line. And the town went ahead and we put up barriers, but it closed no trespassing on the railway bridge itself. And it's proven in how many reports that we've seen that saying that railway line ends and doesn't go anywhere. It's just going across behind somebody's property. I always try to put yourself in the other person's position, all right, or the other farmer's position or the other thing. What would you feel? Now, we've already gone through all these public meetings and discussions and everything else, and then we're going to leave it to a new council, and you never know who you're going to get, and they're going to say, oh, by the way, we're going to make this into a walking trail. Now, you've got the county arguing about homelessness. You know, you're going to leave public property behind a multi-million dollar farm, and they're not supposed to be upset. I would lose my mind.
Councillor Angela Hicks explained why deferring to the ad hoc committee was council's best option.
I don't have a crystal ball, but I do not foresee in 50 years any way possible for that rail line. And again, that's already been determined by the ad hoc committee, and council has accepted their recommendations. I don't agree necessarily with putting it up for sale right now, but I think it should be. We can remove the resolution. I like the resolution because it's there and it's a glaring reminder to everyone on this council and future councils that it needs to be dealt with, that there is a project underway. It's just sitting there. It's not doing anything. I don't know what the amount of money would be that we would get for it, but I think good faith to the ratepayers of the town and the ad hoc committee is to just leave it, not sell it right now until we've made further headway with the MTO on getting over or under the 401.
Shank noted potential plans he's seen and the importance of the recommendation of the ad hoc committee.
If the trail was going somewhere and it was not in a dead end, you would have an argument on leaving it open and not having it in a surplus list. Camden Road, when they expand the 401, they will be doing redevelopment on that bridge, in a walking or whatever. A couple of designs that I saw was one going north with the old Skidoo Trail, one going possibly over the Camden Road, over that bridge there. But at no time do I believe MTO will go underground right where the railway bridge is at this current time. So therefore, we got a dead end trail, and we've had some very intelligent people sitting on those committees. And if we say, well, by the way, for the last 3 years that you've been doing this committee, and we're, you know what, we don't agree with you, and you've already come to our public meetings, and you gave our presentation, and we didn't question you there, and now we're going to go ahead and say, ah, we don't want to sell it, when they're saying, hey, guys, we don't need it, well, I don't want to be down that road.
CAO Matthew Grant explained what future talks with the ad hoc committee could look like.
I'm confident that they would be very receptive to, you know, sharing their perspectives that they've already given, and to hearing that we're open to making on the ground progress on, you know, trails within the town. I think in some of the conversations that I've had, is talk is great, but investing in some of the trail stuff that we have on the ground is even better.
Staff confirmed that any discussion on the sale of the lands cannot occur until it has been deemed surplus by council. This procedure would need to be accompanied by public consultation. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about Chief Tanar Simpson's efforts to combat the opioid crisis within the Alderville First Nations community.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Alderville First Nation Chief Tanar Simpson is not only taking a tougher stance on fentanyl and opioid drug use, but also helping those addicted. Simpson says he wants the ability to unlock new government support when declaring a state of emergency, be able to enforce Alderville's own trespassing legislation, and construct and open an addictions treatment facility.
It's not just Alderville, it's all First Nations in Canada. So when we're talking about fentanyl and opioid poisoning, people on reserve are 5.6 times more likely to have an overdose in their community. So with those numbers, we can't deny that there's a crisis, and the resolution that we passed in the Assembly, First Nations Assembly, was that we are recognizing this crisis, and we're naming the crisis, and we're asking for those supports. When you have a population that's isolated, that doesn't have the supports in place to the degree that they are off reserve and in the cities, we are looking at a crisis that we just don't have the tools to solve at this point. We are also trying to take steps to ensure that we can criminally prosecute and effectively basically trespass dealers out of the reserve, even if they are citizens of the community or if they're not. So we're looking for those increased powers to be able to effectively manage the crisis. And Alderville might not be as bad off as some of the other First Nation communities, but we do stand together. That was what this resolution was all about, that it's such a big issue that it's something that's across the board for First Nations in Canada.
Now, let's just dive into your community for a bit here. How would you classify the opioid use in your community?
This is really hard to put your finger on, because we only know what we know. So it's hard to know what's happening behind closed doors. We know that we've had some unfortunate incidents in the past, and we do have supports in place here. We have Healthy Lifestyles staff. They used to be called NADAP workers. But we have the supports in place for people that reach out and seek that help. But we can't go in and force people to get help. And it's hard to identify who the people would be. So we don't quite have the authority to basically really get to the bottom of it. And at the same time, like, we have to balance people's privacy. So it's quite a sticky situation. So we're just looking to be able to increase our supports and be ready for those people, create an opening for people to come forward to us, create that environment where it's safe to come to us and ask for help. So though that's where our focus is on right now.
Now, when you talk about supports, obviously addiction treatment is going to be a key component. Harm reduction is also going to probably be another key component. Have you had discussions with the province of Ontario or the federal government about opening up addiction treatment spaces in facilities and maybe more on the ground harm reduction supports?
Yes, we have. So we actually have a proposal into the federal government for funding to open Williams Treaty First Nations Addiction Treatment Center. We have the location all picked out. It's a very nice location. It's nestled in a very natural environment on the water. So we feel this is an ideal location to bring First Nation citizens to seek help and to get help. So we're just hoping that that proposal is approved. We have partners that they're all lined up, and we're just waiting for that. So it's one of those things where we're just playing the waiting game. We have the solution, but we're just waiting for it to be approved.
Now, earlier you talked about trespassing and possibly legislation. First Nations, I'm not aware of whether your First Nation has this or not, but the ability to pass legislation that would impact their lands directly on reserve legislation. Have you contemplated that? And what do you think the trespassing drug use legislation would look like?
Well, under our Chinook-Nagaywin, which is our constitution, we have the ability to make laws of this sort. The problem is it's not enforceable. We have tried to get Anishinaabeg Nation policing, First Nations policing, but we have been unsuccessful to this point, despite, you know, years of trying to get this sort of policing. So we are under OPP, catchment area, and the OPP are not obligated to enforce our laws. So this creates a gap where we can make laws to trespass bad actors off our reserve, but the OPP and Canada and Ontario are under no obligation to enforce those laws. So we are being hampered by this red tape, by the OPP not wanting to basically come in and do what we're asking them to do under our laws. So this is why we are looking for First Nation or Anishinaabeg policing in our community, which we have been told we are not going to get. So it's very frustrating when we know what the solution is, but we aren't able to instigate it.
So how do you go forward then in trying to clean up where you think there's a problem and get rid of bad actors?
Yes. So if we know that there's something happening right now, we would report it to the OPP, and then we kind of have to cross our fingers and hope something happens. In the past in Alderville, we've taken matters into our own hands. There's a lot of legal ramifications and issues involved with that. We want to work within the system. We feel the system should be able to manage this crisis, but we are getting pushback and roadblocks every step of the way. So it's very frustrating. It's something we've never given up on. We are always trying to make things better like this, but you know, it's just, we really should have already had this settled, and we could put our efforts into other aspects that our community needs. So when we're constantly fighting a fight that we are up against a brick wall, it's wasting our resources, it's wasting our time, and it's just so obvious that this is a solution that's required, but it's not coming. So it's just a very frustrating situation to be in.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Thursday, September 18th, daytime high of 23 degrees with plenty of bright sunshine, dropping down to 13 overnight. Friday, September 19th, another sunny day with slightly less humidity than Thursday, also dropping down to half the overnight temperature with an overnight low of 6 degrees. Saturday, September 20th, daytime high of 18 with a mix of sun and cloud dropping down to 9 overnight. Sunday, September 21st, daytime high of 21 but a lot of low cloud coverage, daytime low of 15. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 22nd, daytime high of 22 with a 49% chance of precipitation, but otherwise it will be a lovely day here in the city of Kingston. The Queen's Gaels traveled to Toronto over the weekend to renew hostilities with one of their original rivals. The very first Queens versus Toronto football game was actually played in the fall of 1887. The Gaels came out hot on Saturday, putting up the first touchdown of the game on a 35-yard strike from quarterback Alex Vraken to wide receiver number 16, Nathan Falcone.
Completion to Nathan Falcone, and Nathan Falcone gets a block from Matt Camillo. See ya! Touchdown, Queens! Nathan Falcone, thanks in no small part to an outstanding effort from number 8, Matt Camillo. They put the first touchdown of the game on the board.
However, after that opening touchdown, scoring would slow to a crawl, and midway through the second quarter, we had a 10-6 scoreline that wouldn't have looked out of place in the fall of 1887. With less than 4 minutes to go in the first half, Toronto's all-conference quarterback Scott Barnett threw his first interception of the season to number 22, John Corscadden. Unfortunately for the Gaels, their offense would go two and out. But then number 22 would strike again.
Varsity Blues over the middle, picked off again! John Corscadden again! Scott Barnett going 2-for-2 against number 22, his second pick in less than 2 minutes.
John Corscadden's second interception of the second quarter set up a Nathan Falcone touchdown to give the Gaels a 17-6 lead at half. Queens would assert their dominance in the third quarter with another touchdown from Nathan Falcone, his third of the game, and a touchdown scamper from number 29, Jared Kasari, his first of the season. The Gaels would drop the hammer in the fourth, tallying another touchdown courtesy of Jared Kasari, and two more interceptions, including a record-setting third in the ballgame for John Corscadden. The Gaels are on the road again on Saturday, September 20th to play the Waterloo Warriors. Kickoff is scheduled for 1 p.m. and you can catch all the action on CFRC 101.9 FM.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.